All right. So today we are chatting with Mr. Sean Ruggieri. So Sean is an Emmy Award-winning cinematographer specializing in underwater documentaries. So Sean has extensive experience diving cameras and underwater housings. He's also rocked a few submarines, ROVs. But the way that I met Sean was that he actually joined Red Digital Cinema back in 2007, just before the launch of the Red One. He was working with Red through those years and specialized in both helping camera departments as the cameras were rolled out into the field, but then also, you know, due to his love of underwater, spent an awful lot of time taking those cameras below the depths and then helping with the development of that underwater capability. The other thing that I probably didn't realize until I was researching Sean was his lengthy IMDb background that, you know, gave me a big smile because he worked on, you know, Spider-Man, Gone Girl, Thor, Mindhunter, Game of Thrones, which, you know, is all very cool. But then obviously his latest adventures have even seen him out on Ocean X when they did their maiden voyage to the Red Sea. And then the other thing that we absolutely have to cover today is, you know, the stuff he does with NASA. So, Sean, you're absolute legend. Mate, thank you for taking the time to be with me today.
It's my pleasure, Scott. I appreciate you having me on. I'm glad to join you.
Mate, so excited to have you here because, you know, again, you're the sort of man that, you know, doesn't mention all these cool things that you do. You're as humble as a man can be. But, buddy, look, I've heard this story, but for people not listening, mate, take me on a journey. You obviously, you know, love of the water as a young man. Talk to me about that time. Like, what was it that called you to the ocean?
Oh, it's always been calling. Since I can remember, since I was a little kid, my plan was to be a marine biologist. So everything ocean I could get my hands on, any book, any, you know, nature special that was on TV or a film I could go watch, whether it's Jacques Cousteau or, you know, some of the more local legends and things like that. I just gobbled it up. Way before diving, you know, I was out snorkeling in our local waters constantly, try to get out there, you know, weekly, if not every couple days, surfing as much as I could, just total fish, you know, salty dog while I was still a puppy, you know? I got to say the marine biology thing, I love all the marine biologists I've worked with. And I, you know, I have so much respect for the dedication it takes them to get to that place. And then also to continue that work. I knew pretty early on, I was not disciplined enough, both school wise and just personality wise to stay in that game, to become a marine biologist. So, not, you know, a few departures. Yeah, I study as much as I possibly can because it's personal enrichment, and then it leads perfectly into the work I do too. I want to know my environment when I'm in it, and on top of that, you know, the more you know about what you're filming, let's say underwater, sometimes you can predict behaviors. Sometimes you can know where you are in a certain environment and know what you might find way before you're even starting to look for it. Things like that. But didn't become a marine biologist apparently. But
yeah, well, look, marine biology is the obvious one. I always thought that, you know, the idea of being a dolphin trainer would have been pretty cool.
Oh, that was huge to me too. I know. As much as I have this kind of love-hate relationship with, you know, captive animals and stuff like that as a child, correct, watching dolphin trainers work with the dolphins at the local SeaWorld and stuff, it blew my mind. And actually, that's speaking cool of that, I was at one when I was a kid. I was probably about 8, 9 years old, and it was in between show times, and I witnessed one of the dolphin trainers playing catch with a ball with one of the dolphins. And I came down to watch, and the trainer was just like, "Come on over, little guy. You want to try this?" And I got to play catch with a dolphin at like 8 or 9 years old. And yeah, that was cool. Set the hooks in me even more, you know?
And see, we didn't really understand, you know, the animals in captivity thing, you know, 35 years ago. It probably wasn't, sure, you know, as heavily considered. But it was just extraordinary, particularly, you know, with the animals like the dolphins and just watching the way that they would interact with humans and just how incredible they were.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, those intelligent beings, Being able to be trained for one thing, it's,
Yes.
it takes a high level of intelligence. And it is tough because when you have animals that are that intelligent and they're aware of their environments, it seems even tougher for the heart to enjoy seeing
Yeah.
them. But then there's also the other aspects. Like, I still love going to aquariums, and there's a huge role they play when it comes to bringing awareness to people that are never going to take themselves out of those critters'
Correct.
environments, and making them care for them. You watch kids fall in love with these, sea lions or whatever they are, and
Oh,
all of a sudden they care about them. They want to protect them. They
totally.
now have a new awareness.
And it's massive. I actually took my son to the Antarctic. So it's the base station that they fly out of in New Zealand to actually
Yeah.
get you down there. And they've
How
actually
cool.
got a program there where they, care for penguins, in particular ones that can't be re-released into the wild. Because they've had an injury or whatever, and so they actually take them there and they care for them and they look after them. And like my son just thought that that was the coolest thing he'd ever seen.
Totally.
Watching and learning about them there.
Yeah, that's what I love too. Yeah, all of our local aquariums that I know of, that's the majority of their focus. Of course they want to present these animals to the public and teach them about them, but it's usually a rescue and rehabilitation and hopefully release
Yeah.
back into the wild type of thing. And then some of
Absolutely.
them that are never going to be able to make it back in the wild, then they end up living there and
No.
getting
And
fat and happy.
they're made fat and happy. They give them the best life. There's no predators. Like they're just having the best time of their lives. They've won the and it's
Couch
really
potato
nice, I guess.
life.
Yeah, well, it's really changed, hasn't it? In that sense that it is now about, rescue and rehabilitation, whereas, it probably was just more entertainment based back when we were young fellas. Now,
True.
obviously, so the ocean spoke to you, but how did you end up taking pictures?
Yeah, great segue, because it really, like, as I started to lose, no, I wouldn't say interest, but kind of coming to a realization that I wasn't going to go in the direction of a PhD program or something like that. It was actually, I didn't have any photography classes in my high school, which I really wish I did. But then when I first started at college or uni, as you all
Yeah.
typically say, right? My first year there, I took my first photography course, 101, shooting massive rolls of film, developing them, and printing, 8x10s in the dark room, and just absolutely
So
fell in
cool.
love with that. And that was, when I started that, my father was, he was an amateur photographer, did it for his own passion. His
Yeah.
stuff was more like street photography, portrait stuff. He handed me down his Canon AE-1 that was made in 76. I got the guts rebuilt
Dude.
on it, and then just started shooting that thing like crazy. And I was in love, man. And
Yeah,
then
how good's an
yeah.
81? Like, that's just a great camera.
I still use it. I love it. Yeah, like when my son was born, that was the first thing I thought was, okay, gotta go get some more rolls of black and white and start shooting
Yeah.
this thing again. Yeah, I love that camera.
Hey, funny story. I've got a Canon 1V, so like their sports film camera, their sports 35 millimeter camera. And I've actually taken that traveling, with the family. And some of my favorite shots that I've ever taken, like I've only got, three or four photos that I've taken out of the hundreds of thousands, are off that camera. Mate, a bit of Kodak Portra 400.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Oh, dude. Like I've got photos from when we were last in the States with him, like in, New York and on the steps where Sylvester Stallone's, doing these ones.
Yeah, the Rocky thing.
And
Yeah,
oh
totally. That's
man, and
cool.
I've got these photos of my wife and this like tiny little dude sitting there next to him, like shot on that camera in Portra. And like they're just special, aren't they?
They really are. Yeah, that was the first thing I went and I was like, can I still find plenty of Portra? And totally was able to, just
Yeah.
online. And yeah, that's what I was shooting my newborn son with a bunch too. It is special. And the process too, right? Of you really
Oh
having
man.
to be much more selective, no spray and pray type of scenarios, and you're really paying attention to setting up the shot. Yeah.
It's a good thing to come back to, like as a digital shooter. And that was actually part of the reason
Sure.
I picked it up again was, sports photography, occasionally you've got to do a little bit of spray and pray when things are happening.
Absolutely.
But you can get sloppy where you're sort of taking, 2,000 photos a day and going, hang on, this is silly.
I
Whereas
gotta
it
edit this
forces you
now.
to. Yeah, could you sort of go, mate, each photo is costing me like $6. I should probably, use some care and some diligence.
Totally.
Man, I'm glad you still use that. So you still shoot with the AE-1 now?
Yeah. Every once in a while, it just reminded me now. It's probably been at least a year or so since I picked it up. I gotta get
Yeah,
back
dude.
on
Man, time to punch
it.
a roll through
Totally,
that
totally.
thing. And have you
Yeah.
got a housing for it? When did you start putting them
I
underwater?
no. Yeah, underwater came much later. I mean, for me, the underwater stuff started as simple as you can, with small point and shoots, really cheap stuff. And then, of course, with the development of GoPros and those came along, of course, I was doing that stuff for a while. And
Yeah.
then about 10 years ago was the first time that I put a red underwater.
And that was sort of where it started.
I mean, I was always so interested in it and a total fish at the time anyways.
Yeah.
But to finally get a professional camera in a professional housing, it was the red one in a Gates Underwater Products housing, the housing they made for the red one.
And
And
that's
then
how it
the
started.
that is how it started and just ignited 100%.
Dude.
I knew right away that I needed to focus on this. I
Yeah, that
was,
was the moment. You're like,
yeah,
the window is open.
100%.
This is it. Like, go,
Yeah,
go,
yeah.
go.
Now the window's
Because, like,
open. I'm jumping through it and trying to fly like
man,
Superman. If I fall, I fall, but I'm just gonna keep
because
going.
that's a time I really want to talk to you about. Because I sort of went, I've gone and stalked all the way back to your start of your Facebook photos,
Okay.
to, go back and have a look. And one of the photos I did see was a shot of you on the Red One the day before it was shipped to customers. Because obviously you joined Red before the product came out, back when people were still, poo-pooing and going, oh, this will never work.
Sure. Or will it ever
Digital
exist,
cinema,
period?
how stupid, who are these idiots? Some bloke that makes sunglasses thinks he can build a video camera. Good luck, champ. Like, what a time. Like, how did that happen? How did you end up at Red?
I mean, it's just everything you just said right there, just flashbacks of like my first years at Red, all just battling
Yep.
those type of arguments and conversations. How I ended up at Red was I was working, I had a full-time job at a small media house that's local here in Orange County, California, and I was working as an editor. Started there as, an assistant editor, basically logging, doing lower thirds on some of their shows, and then eventually moved myself up to editing whole shows. And how it happened was my boss was going to go to NAB, the National Association of
Yeah.
Broadcasters, the big convention we have out here. And he grabbed, I want to say, like one or two of the employees from the media house to take with him to Vegas in NAB.
Right.
And I was not one of them. But when they came back, all they were talking about was this company, Red. That was the 2006 NAB when Red
Yeah.
basically announced themselves, even though they didn't have a product yet.
We're coming. No.
And immediately, like, I was just eating up all their information. So I just dove in research wise as much as I could and just spent many sleepless nights just researching what's going on, following the forums, Red user.
Yeah.
And realistically, how it happened was I kind of stalked Red and wouldn't leave them alone until they would give me a job. I sent an
Nice.
initial email and just said, I can see that this is the future. I know where this is going. I know how important this is. I want to be part of it.
Yeah.
And they said, we really appreciate your passion, but we don't even have a product yet. So please stand by. And
Give it a minute,
hopefully
champ.
sometime in the
Pretty
future.
good.
Yeah. And
Yeah.
so realistically, I just kept coming after them, every couple months, just for friendly reminder, I'm still here, still interested, being
Yeah.
dedicated to the cause. And eventually they brought me in. And after three interviews, my fourth interview was sitting down with Jim Gennard, the owner and
Wow.
creator of Red. And we, it was a really, you can't really call it a job interview because it was a conversation and it was awesome. We sat down and we just started chatting about digital cameras and digital cinema. And at some point, 45 minutes into the conversation or whatever it was, he said, "Well, so do you want to see the Red One prototype?" And I
What?
was like, "Yeah,
You're like,
absolutely."
dude.
And went in the back, and there was one of the prototypes with one of the heads of engineering and one of the guys, Brent Carter, who had initially set up my interviews. He looked at me, he goes, "You know what this means, right? If you're looking at this camera right now." I go, "Does this mean I got the job?" He goes, "Yeah, you
Welcome
got the
to the
job." So,
family.
yeah. So,
Dude,
yeah, I was
that's
employee
wild.
21. Yeah, it was wild.
Employee number 21. Holy, that's that, like, that's madness. Because that, I've obviously followed all of this very closely, because I obviously loved what Red did in terms of like just coming in and going, screw you all, we're doing it our way. Like, I really liked that rock and roll approach, which, you know, can...
It needed to happen to the industry. Let's be real. It really needed to happen.
They came in and flipped it on its head. And, like, tell me about those early days. I mean, mate, you're there testing the camera because there's photos of you, like, you've got it at the football, you're out, you know, doing things with it. What was that time like? I mean, that must have been wild.
Oh, it was so wild, man. It's, you know, there's no way I could probably keep up with the pace at my age now, but it was a blast then because we were, it was a total lifestyle for us. You know, we would, you know, sleep at the office quite frequently, just days and nights, testing stuff and then taking it out to a shoot in the morning. Initially, I became one of the first on-set techs for these cameras while also helping start to develop the internal tech support department that hired me to be tech support and customer service. And so I started developing that department with Brent and a couple others, and then going out to sets and trying to support these cameras being on set, both for the reason that it's brand new technology. So realistically, it's the first time, you know, you've got all these working professionals that may have been in the industry for decades. However, it's something they've never had their hands on. So they need a bit of guidance, but also, to be real, those out there that were with Red in the very early days know that there were some struggles. I mean, it was, like people say, bleeding edge technology. I mean, there was, there was so much going on in these tiny cameras that of course you're going to have some issues, and, you know, development was happening so fast. So I was there to try to help fix these issues on set. And the way I see it too, I was also there to take some of the heat off of the camera department that was on the productions as
I was the red guy. Yeah.
Where's the effing red guy?
Yeah. Where's he, mate? You were the punching
bag. Behind you. Yeah. So that was all part of the job, you know, but that was worth it. But there were some wild days.
Oh man, it's just such a hardcore story, you know, to have been in there, you know, on, you know, that coal face as that technology was rolled out. Yeah. Because, you know, how did you find the resistance? Like, how did you find people going, this, you know, this digital rubbish? Like,
it was tough. I mean, for one thing, 4K was never going to be a thing to people in their mind. I mean, 1080 was plenty. And I mean, look at where we are now, where 4K is possibly not enough for most people. I'll tell you how I found the resistance. I'll try to make it a quick story, but one of the first sets I ever went out on, and I know I could tell this story publicly because I've actually read an article where the director told the same story, slightly different from the way I remember it, but it's okay. it was Gamer with Gerard Butler, and this had to be 2007, I believe, is when they started shooting it. And so first day of production, this sequence is, and it's the very first sequence they're going to shoot of the entire movie. And it's Gerard Butler's stunt double running down an alley. An explosion goes off next to him and, you know, blows him to bits, it looks like. But then the director, who's, they're amazing, Neville Dean Taylor, they like to camera operate themselves a lot. And so he was in a full fire retardant suit and complete, done up. And he's going to run through the fireball after the stunt double with the camera and then reveal that, you know, Gerard Butler's okay and goes on with the fight. So basically they run down the alley, explosion goes off. They're both running through a fireball. You know, like I said, he's in a fire retardant outfit. The camera is wrapped in like a plastic bag from what I remember, like a throw over trash bag when it rains. Camera cuts off during the explosion. Immediately there's panic and like, wait a minute, it can't take the concussion of things like this. This entire movie, if you've ever seen it, the entire movie is explosions, gunfights and things like that. So if this camera can't take this, it's not going to work. Let's do it again. Runs through the explosion, cuts off. They do it a third time, it cuts off again, if I'm remembering the amount of times. And basically the producers came to me right then and said, okay, so this is the thing. We're going to break for lunch. You need to look at your camera, figure out what's going on with it. We're going to try this one more time after lunch. If that camera fails again, we're pulling the 435s off of the truck. And this film is now going to be shot on film. And one of the first major movies for Red is not going to be shot on Red anymore. I had already... No pressure at all. I mean, there's a reason why I have so much gray hair of what hair is left. But but I already had voiced my concern and what I thought it was. And it didn't seem like it wanted to be listened to. But Long story short is back then with Red Ones, if anybody remembers them, there was also a side record button right here. And I was saying that I think that's smashing against the operator's face when the explosion's going off. So basically, we put a bunch of gaff tape over that thing at lunchtime. They came back, they shot it one more time. The camera didn't cut out because that side record button was taped over. And they watched playback, and everybody just uproar cheering, "Oh my God, it's beautiful. It looks so great."
Oh, God.
And yeah, so the movie went on being shot on Red. You know, that night we popped off all the side record buttons, which leads to later on
Wow.
a development in the camera software where you can go into the menus and disable that side record button.
Of
So the
course.
trial by fire R&D is really what it was,
Oh,
right? Like you're figuring out
dude.
how to develop these things in the middle of a war zone, kind
You know, all you've done there is you've gone on to confirm that gaff tape does indeed fix everything.
Yes,
Mate,
absolutely.
what would we
Absolutely.
do without gaff tape and zip ties?
That's the truth.
Oh, dude, that is actually ridiculous. I mean, because that's the sort of stuff. I mean, that's pressure when it's just your set and, you know, something's playing up. But when it's your technology on, you know, a Hollywood film, and everybody's looking at you, like people want you to fail in the early days. Like they don't want to see the
Very
young
true.
upstart get up. You know,
Yeah,
they
very
want
true.
their poo-pooing to come true for God knows what reason.
Yeah,
Like
I mean,
that's
most
just
people just
brutal.
couldn't, just wanted the excuses to be able to make it go away and go back to doing
Yeah.
things the way
Digital
they
sucks.
used
We
to.
want film.
Yeah. And you
Oh,
know, and
man.
so I love like the ongoing early quotes and things that Jim, the founder, would always say is, you know, we all knew that digital was going to end up taking over film. Maybe not
Absolutely.
entirely, but it was going to take
Yeah.
over a lot of the industry. So
For a big part.
one of his main missions was to give it a respectful replacement. You know, not saying that,
Yeah.
okay, 1080, 24p, that's going to be sufficient and that's a great replacement for how this beautiful 35 millimeter plus film has trained
Correct.
us to see cinema our whole lives, you know. So the
Yeah.
whole point was, well, if it's going to happen, let's make it happen beautifully, you know. Let's give it a
Yeah.
proper a proper next step.
And see, that is a lovely way because, you know, my understanding of Jim, again, not somebody I've met personally, but, you know, from things I've read that he's written, is, you know, he's obviously a very passionate, you know, photographer, cinematographer himself.
Yeah.
And he really did do his best to translate all of that into the company that he founded. Like that sort of formed the ethos, didn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean he's a really talented photographer, and he a lot of people didn't know it, but a lot of the ad campaigns for Oakley, he shot them himself, both stills and motion campaigns. And I remember him telling me that story, and I know I've heard it a couple other times, is where it almost the company was almost created out of a frustration of how he would buy the leading technology from one of these big camera companies, and then 3 months later it was like, well, now we've got something better. But you know,
Yeah.
you it's there was no upgrade paths or anything like that, like Red offered. So it was
Yeah.
like, well, this has to change, and he's going to be the
Stuff
one to
it, doing
change
it
it. He had the
myself.
means. Yeah.
'Cause see, I had read that he shot a lot of his own campaigns. And I mean, a lot of the Oakley stuff is so iconic. You know, I was shaped by Oakley as a brand as a young man in the 90s. You know, I had my sweet wraparounds. Like I was all about, like their style was just so cool. And I think that was one of the things that I really liked that they carried into the camera company. You know, it wasn't just, you know, the Germans or the Japanese where it's just absolute, you know, precision in what they do and it's very toe the line. Like I really, the rock and roll style, I think that's the only thing I can ever relate it to,
Totally.
of the way that.
I always called us a bunch of punk rock bands smashed
Yeah.
into a small room,
Oh
you
man,
know, with a
it's as
product to
punk rock as I
deliver.
could see. Because the evolution that, you know, I truly fell in love with was the Red Epic. Like talk to me about the transition from like, you know, the Red One to the Epic. Like how was that? Obviously it was a natural progression, but I mean it felt like, you know, not just, you know, a bit cheesy, but not evolution, but full revolution.
Sure. Yeah, I mean it was a big jump. I just know when it came to internally with development wise, without me, you know, just saying anything I shouldn't, but things we're really focused on trying to make everything smaller, of course, more efficient, but also even better quality. You know, that was never going to be a sacrifice. It was always, you know, let's up the ante when it comes to the quality of what we can deliver, but how can we make this smaller, and even cheaper at times too, right? But when the Epic bodies were being developed, if you remember that point in time, 3D had its big revolution. So that became a requirement out of the gate. That need this because the red ones were starting to be used on these big beam splitter 3D rigs. Were just enormous, massive things. Those are the
So
things
good,
of my
man.
nightmare because as if things aren't as complicated enough, now you've got two cameras instead of one with twice the cabling and GAC and accessories and all the other stuff involved. So
Madness.
the Epics had to be these smaller boxes that worked into the 3D world better, which for a lot of us worked into many of our worlds, the underwater industry working into a housing, of course. You know,
It
when
all
it came
makes
to the
perfect
gimbal
sense.
revolution and Steadicam revolutions and, you know, putting them on car mounts and things like this,
Oh, man.
everything just had it had an advantage in that direction.
Well, it did. The smaller, lighter, and faster, became the whole thing. But look, we're probably jumping forward a little bit here because you've got to tell me a little bit about. So obviously, Red and Gates was a really strong partnership, and that started with Red One. Like, how far into the journey was that?
Well, they met, I work really closely with Gates and the owner, John Ellerbrock, owns a company with his wife, Karen. He's told the story numerous times that I've heard where he was introduced to the company and introduced to Jim at the 2006 NAB
Yeah, right.
presentation, the big unveiling. Of what we will be. May not have a product yet, but here's some machined prototypes and they, you know, they seems like they hit it off and they're like, okay, you're the underwater guy. Let's start working
Let's
closely.
get it
And
done.
still to this day, you know, there's a really tight relationship between Red and Gates when it comes to engineering and development of products. So they're working really closely with their product development team, which is a really brilliant team that Red has at this point right now too. And
Absolutely.
so,
And
yeah.
how did you insert yourself into that conversation? Because obviously you went, hey, I like the ocean stuff.
Yeah.
Camera, ocean, me. Let me
Yeah.
be the glue that holds those together. How did you manage to jump yourself in there?
I guess it would kind of be similar to the way I got the job at Red was just
Yeah, gotcha. So you
barged
just
my way in and
push.
said, I'm taking
Yep.
this. I want
Hello.
this. I want,
Hello. That'll be
yeah,
me.
but it was such a passion for me that too, that I was already trying to network with. You know, I'd speak with hundreds, if not, you know, 1,000 people, every couple days to a week that were out there shooting reds. And when it was somebody that was out shooting nature docs, the natural history stuff always really was interesting to me. I might spend a little extra time on the phone with them, you know, and picking their brain and supporting them. So I was already building a network of those
Yeah, so cool.
folks before I was even really getting involved in it myself.
Before you were the guy, you were like, I can see which way I want this to go.
Yeah, that and you know, I could tell that Red works brilliantly for so many parts of the industry. And I knew, yeah, sports and stuff like that too, but I knew like nature, this is nature's baby. This is what they want. It's
Oh man.
small, it's really high
Absolutely.
definition with the beautiful picture, but also the high frame rates that weren't being offered on other cameras, which is
It's
just an absolute must for
massive.
nature stuff. Yeah.
Because yeah, who the hell wants to be working a big film camera out in the jungle or attempting to? I've seen some of the big boxes where they've tried, film cameras underwater and stuff. I don't know if that's
Yeah.
correct, but oh man, that looks
Yeah.
terrible.
I'd love to touch on that because yeah, in my earliest days, so you know, John Ellerbrock, owner of Gates, is one of my really close friends to this day, but also a mentor to me. And he introduced me to a lot of folks, including Bob Cranston. Rest in peace, Bob, legend. And he was a big, big pioneer of digital filmmaking underwater and 3D as well. So Bob Cranston and Howard Hall, two of the biggest names in the industry, and they were a close working partnership for a long time. And they would shoot IMAX film beam splitter 3D rigs underwater. And if I remember right,
Dude.
the things were like, I think I remember Bob saying they were about 1,200 pounds I'm sorry, I'm pounds over here in the States, whatever kg that is. Yeah, you got these big cranes that you'd have to bring it into the water with. Bob and Howard would be on rebreathers down there. They get, a minute or whatever, few seconds of roll time, and then they'd have to send the rig back up with a diver to get the film reloaded, and then it would have to come back down with the new divers so they weren't getting anybody bent and, decompression sickness. So they'd have to switch out their support. So all that fast forwards then to the Gates version of this is a beam splitter rig for the Epics. And, 1,200 pounds went to about 300 pounds, but tiny. You're talking about the old IMAX rigs were the size of like a VW Beetle, something like that,
Just silly. And that's what I'd seen was like these things were just monstrous. And it's one thing on a set where you've got explosions going off and it's all a bit, but for people working in that nature documentary, they'd just be like going, oh, you've saved me.
What a whole new set of logistics, right? And just and those type of things just really limit your possibilities. You have
Well,
to
they
start
do.
working around the limitations and versus what would be a perfect thing to shoot and how to shoot it, but we can't,
Because it just won't work. And I guess that would have been so obviously you had the red one underwater. And how did that go? How did that go? Like the first times, you took it.
I mean, I was fixated on it immediately. It went great. That was by the time I got the red one underwater, it was right when Gates was finishing development on a housing for the Epic. And so I was lucky enough to get a transition really quickly into that. And it led to me making the first of a series of videos I did for Red. Where it was basically before the camera comes out or right after it comes out, get it underwater, and it's the first ever seen underwater footage of these cameras, kind of a test case
So
scenario.
cool.
And that was the first one I did for them. I called it Water Breathing Dragon, and it was with Bob Cranston and Johnny Friday, who's a close friend as well. And we went out to the local island here, Catalina,
Oh,
and
dope.
we were trying to find the opalescent squid spawning, and we just the trip was close to over, and then we just landed right on it. And just you're talking about these squids spawning by the billions,
Oh, man.
shooting it both in day and night. And it was just the most surreal, mind-blowing thing I've ever seen. And that I was already hooked the second I was started shooting underwater, but that trip right there and that shoot, and then me coming back and I edited it myself, and tried to direct the whole piece myself. That's when I knew, well, this is what I'm gonna do. This is it. That I just went to this. I just went to outer space in my mind, and this is where I want to keep going back to.
You're like, this is it. This is my jam. And like, what a time. So, the start of the Epic, because the Epic, I think, was the time when Red, really transformed from, some new whiz bang good luck to you to hang on a second, like this, not mucking around here. Because the thing that I remember, because I was shooting motorsport at that time, and I went over to, the American Series Formula Drift. They were doing stuff in Southeast Asia, and one of the dudes who was shooting there had his Red Epic in like 2010 shooting drifting. And like drifting, it's not considered top tier motorsport here. Again, it's a bit rock and roll. And like, I remember watching him work and watching the footage that that camera produced. And I'm just there banging around with my stills camera. And I remember looking at that tiny little camera package and then what he was producing with it and going, man, one day, like
That's
one day.
it. Yeah. You know where you were going. Yeah, for
Oh
sure.
man, it was just like, it was the what they could make with it, like the quality and the style and the look. It was just like nothing I'd ever seen. And having, again, having a small camera package that was like portable, but also just the highest quality, you could achieve. Because you think about like an Alexa back then. I mean, man, it was like a Besser block with a lens on the front of it. Like that is not something that you'd take to the local drift track to film some cars, at high frame rate,
Sure.
blazing past you at 100K an hour.
All
Like
good for
that
the
was.
typical shoulder mount, but yeah, I mean, it became a whole new
Oh,
style of
yeah.
shooting where people did this kind of right to the chest and, you know,
Yeah,
that type of
handheld,
thing
and
where
you,
the
yeah, you
hand.
get it in there, and
Yeah.
yeah, you're in with the action, but you're in there, you know, with a cinema camera. And that was when I remember, like, Red Bull started, you know, shooting stuff with it, and they were doing like extreme sports stuff with it. And this was probably closer to 2012 or thereabouts. And like, I just remember seeing like wild stuff being done. It was all still, you know, a little bit out there in traditional land, but I've never been super interested in traditional land. I've always liked, you know, that bleeding edge stuff and where that goes. Because that would have been
Yes,
when,
man.
you know, in terms of your work on sets, you know, where it was being, because what was it? Spider-Man was 2012-ish, wasn't it? Or thereabouts? Was that Epics or
Oh God, it all
trying to
bleeds
remember?
together. It was Epics, yeah. It was
Yeah.
actually one of the, I want to say it was before that, because it was one of the very first shows the Epics were on. And I mean, this was the earliest days of development in them, and they immediately had to work on 3D beam splitter rigs. And you know, there was constantly like four rigs working at once, if not more.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how that didn't kill a lot of us, but myself and Nate Hart spent a lot of time on that set too. And we would basically go work 12, you know, sometimes 14-hour days or whatever it was on set, and
Oh,
come
dude.
up with the list of maybe issues we saw, but a lot of times more so just things that need to be integrated into the software, things that need to
Yep.
change, things that are just going to help the workflow on set. And as we're sending that in while we're on set, the engineers are developing this new software. We get done with our big long day on set, and then we go back to the lab, pop in the new
Wow.
firmware, and then retest the things we saw happening there and try, and, you know, sleep never type of.
Man,
So speaking of Red Bull, there was a lot of Red Bulls that happened.
that, but like,
Yeah.
that's wild times. Like, that really
Yeah.
is. Like, it's still, as I said, like, that is young man's work. You know, that is not
Totally.
something, you know, going from film sets to the lab to back
There
again.
was
Man, that
so
is.
much energy that was created though, because we knew what we were doing too. And
Yeah.
of course the pressure of the situation is going to keep you awake no matter
Oh,
what. But also it was just,
absolutely.
we all just had so much drive and passion for the
Yeah.
company that it was, you know,
Just
it kept us
make it
going.
work. Oh, man. Like, it just blows me away, you know, hearing all these stories. Because, you know, as I sort of said, you know, I was just a whippersnapper trying to find my feet. And, you know, obviously you're watching all these things from afar, you know, that are going on. Now, with the R&D, I also saw that you were pivotal in assisting the development of the underwater OLPF.
Oh yeah.
Do you want to tell me a little bit about that, how that sort of came to be as you went
Sure.
underwater and you went, oh, hang on a sec?
Yeah, that was definitely an obsession for at least a few years.
Yeah.
And dove into a bunch of studies that, you know, were new to me. And I've mentioned it before and love to mention again that I had the guidance of some really smart people out there, like Dave Blackham from Esprit Films and John Shaw over in your neck of the woods.
Okay.
He's an Aussie, and these folks were already doing the early work that was leading me in the right direction of what we were trying to
Right.
solve. Was especially with Dragon, the Dragon sensor in Epic, you ended up getting a UV cross contamination
Right.
in blue water, or in you know, it's when you're shooting underwater, everything changes. And one of the most important things is as you go deeper, you know, after you are a couple meters deep, there's zero red light left from the spectrum. It's filtered out by the water. And
Yeah,
as you go
right.
deeper and deeper, right, the different colors of the spectrum disappear. That's why when we look down into water, we see blue typically. That's not because the water's blue. It's because that is the most color that will penetrate that deep into that
Really?
water through the light. Yeah, so basically everything else is filtered out down at depth besides the blue. That's the
Oh,
only thing left. So it's, I'll try not to go off on too much of a tangent on this, on a
man, I love this. It's great.
nerd based
Hey.
tangent,
Oh,
but
man,
yeah,
no.
basically what would happen is this crystal clear blue water, especially that of like the Caribbean and things like this, and
Yeah.
really if it had a bit of sediment in it too, it highlighted it, is that water would turn a bit magenta-ish. Everybody started calling
Right.
it the dreaded magenta issue. And it wasn't just a red thing. It wasn't just a
No.
red thing, but CMOS sensor thing in general. And it seemed like Dragon struggled with it more than any of the sensors we had
Gotcha.
before or since. So yeah, basically we ended up developing this optical low pass filter with that system. You know, you could unscrew the optical low pass filter and put in a new one depending on what effect you wanted out of it. And this one had a UV cut at a certain point in the spectrum and a couple other secret sauce little tidbits thrown into it that would help kind of remedy this issue. But again, some of this was done by me following the footsteps of people that went before me and were using these UV cut filters. I would start, you know, it was terrible, terrible part of the job where Red had to send me out to Cayman Islands to go on a dive trip for a week. And I would sample these different filters.
You can test. I mean, you can't do this in the swimming pool, can you?
Yeah, no, not at all. You know, it had to be, it had to be done. Okay, guys, I'll take this one for the team. I'll go out on a dive trip to Cayman Islands. But then I would send this data back, you know, after diving all day and, you know, sometimes shooting fun stuff to try to come up with a proof of concept video to put out. But also, you know, I'm shooting chip charts, shooting color charts and things like that underwater to then that evening send back to our engineers and our color scientist, Graham Natras, absolute brilliant mind. And he would, he would mix it into his magical cauldron and figure out solutions mathematically for it and apply that to basically what the hardware engineers could put into a physical piece of hardware, that optical low pass filter. But then also at the same time, he was figuring out how to change the color science that he is applying of in course. Camera to both that. Optimize the good characteristics and to make sure we're kind of negating some of the ones we wanted to get rid of.
And see, that's wild. And I think one of the other things I've always really loved about Red is how people, you know, like Graham, you know, are really involved, you know, in the community and speak about what they do. And like unknown, you know, it's not just the R&D department that you hide in the basement. It's how active these, you know, all these people are and how critical they've been, you know, in working together. Because again, you know, without you doing that work and without the people that, you know, came before you and, but, you know, you all bring it together and you do it in, I guess, such a collaborative fashion. And you're going to tell me, like, how many goes did it take till you went, oh, this is about right? I mean, what's the time period?
I mean, I can't even imagine what Graham went through and then our other, you know, the other folks on our engineering team, because that's where all the work really ended up happening. I was out there collecting the data and try to present them the worst case scenarios I could and then best case scenarios. And then they did the computing, if you will. You know, they did the real math and the real work to figure out, okay, what are we seeing? Why are we seeing this get better? Why are we seeing this get worse? And then over time, you know, it took a couple of years. And, you know, I want to say, like, I started really concentrating on that project. And by the time we had release of one, it was almost about a 3-year period. But it was, you know, going and doing sample images with these off the shelf filters that we knew were helping improve. And then going back then with our prototype of what we thought was going to work and bringing that all back to the lab and figuring out, you know, did we get it? Did we nail it? But fast forward, you know, I know that those filters, I've been told, help play a big part in some of the biggest BBC blue chip underwater stuff that, you know, was kind of the big re-revolution. I feel like we had a big, big re-revolution, like with Blue Planet 2 and around that time, you know, and Planet Earth 2 and all that stuff where,
Well,
you got so much more interest again.
Yeah.
Oh, nothing they do is easy, but hopefully we helped improve it a tiny bit and could check one thing off the list.
The easy. Because what's crazy is me as somebody who like has enough trouble with cameras, you know, above the water. The only thing I ever think about is like how you'd not get water in the housing. That's like I never think about anything beyond that because I look at putting this thing in a housing, then taking it underwater, and I'm like, dude, if it gets like 2 drops in there, it's game over. I've never really even gone into the depths because I'm too scared to even, you know, unless it's a GoPro and like you've bought the housing for it. And I'm like, oh, look, I can do with, you know, if I burn $500, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, you have a similar viewpoint to most people who are cinematographers, working professionals, honestly. And sometimes that's terrifying. I have to walk folks through some steps at times because, like with me, I I don't rent my housing and my camera gear out without me going at least as a housing tech if I'm not being hired as a camera operator.
Absolutely.
And immediately that is the initial perception is like, right, okay, because we don't want to flood it. You don't want us to mess up your camera or your housing. I said, well, I could teach you how not to do that pretty
Yeah.
quickly. But even if that doesn't happen, there are a million other little things that will blow your chute because you just
Correct.
haven't done this over and over and you haven't gone through the
Yeah.
trial and errors.
You don't have the
And you
experience. And
know, yeah.
that's, as you said, it's that baptism of fire where, you've just done so much of it where things have gone wrong and you've gone, ah, I know a workaround. That's.
I definitely can't say I've seen it all, and I don't want to see it all. Hopefully, but I've seen some weird things happen. Yeah.
Oh man, I can honestly only imagine. And like the launch of well, actually, before I go there's one other thing I wanted to touch on with you, the Red Collective videos. Now, if I recall correctly, you had a pretty big hand in the making of the Red Collective videos. Do I have an
Yeah.
accurate
A handful
recollection of
of
that?
them, yeah. I didn't go out on all of them, but some of the greatest times I read for me, yeah. The first one I did with the crew was Brandy Casagrande. We did, I believe that was the first one I did with them. Then we did one on Paul Nicklin, and then we did one on who we called the Wilds, Shannon and Russ. And yeah, that one we went to. We spent a week in Komodo National Park out in Indonesia filming Komodo dragons, and then spent the next week in Borneo, optically hunting orangutan. And yeah,
So
that
cool.
it was definitely one of the most grueling hard shoots, like dirtiest, gnarliest, nastiest, most uncomfortable thing ever, and greatest time ever too at the same time. It was such a
Always.
fun shoot, but a lot of grueling environments, but it was a blast. Yeah. And it's beautiful too.
Mate, it is, because I've got to tell you, like, as somebody that was, just getting serious about, taking part in that ecosystem, those Red Collective videos in particular, like, mate, they were a massive inspiration to me in those early days. I was like, dude, I want my own Red Collective video. Like, that was like, if you could work your way into a point where they like actually wanted to make something
Yeah.
about what you do, I'm like, man, that's like the pinnacle. That is so cool. Because they
I
were just so
know.
special. Because I watched
They
that and it was
were.
just, man, it was just creators like doing their thing and, taking the tools and then doing what mattered to them. And I'm like, this is just
Yeah.
amazing.
And it was always a big focus of ours to not ever make it feel like a commercial for Red, to not,
No.
like, we never even prompted people to talk about the product or things like
No.
that. If that came up organically because they wanted to talk about something that makes their life easier, better, or has helped them achieve something, that's great. But it was really about telling their story. And then
Yes.
you're gonna see some of the footage that they've shot in their career with the camera. It sells itself because you don't need to, and to me, like, it was such a brilliant marketing device, but it was so much more than that, it's and telling some of those certain stories was similar to, telling pieces of the Red story, because there's so many
It
of you all
was.
out there, yourself included, that just have these brilliant stories. And that's what created Red. It's the community.
Yeah.
It
It's the
both.
mad passion. Like exactly
Yeah,
the same with
totally.
you, the dude that just wouldn't go away until you got a job. Like
Right. Yeah.
you just want to, and that was the thing that I think really drew me into it as well, was I'm like, these people, like I don't know, it was so much more, like it was less about the gear and more about the creator. And, enabling the creator to just go out and do their thing. And I just love that. Like that series was so inspirational for me. Like you've got no idea how many times I watched and rewatched every single one of those videos. Like, before I'd even met you. Yeah, like fully
How
obsessed
cool.
because I'm like, this is, burning into my brain, that level of work, going, man, this is where I want to go.
Love it.
Yeah.
Love it.
It was
It
just, yeah,
worked.
like just a wild ride because,
Yeah.
DSMC2 came along. That was where I sort of jumped into the Red ecosystem. So I was part of the Helium upgrade when that, I'd put money down and then they went, hey, guess what? We're making this 8K thing. And I'm like, sweet baby Jesus, I don't even know what I'd do with 8K, but man, I want
But I
that.
think I need it. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, I totally want that. And they gave us it was a super. Like it was a discounted price to jump up to that camera because we'd put our deposit in so early.
Yeah, I
But like,
remember. Yeah.
I've got to tell you this story because I've got to share this with you.
Please.
Because obviously, like, it was full-blown madness for me to buy that camera at that point in time. Because like, I have no film training. I didn't know how to use one. I'd never used one. I literally had just, you know, watched people use them and gone, I just want that. Like, I'm like, if you want to work with the best, you know, you got to aim for that and you got to, you know, try to use the best tools that you can put in your hand. Sure. And that was it. Like, you know, absolute madness. Like no true. Yeah. Yeah. Like it was all just emotion. It was the vibe, which is, yeah.
It seems like it worked out though, you know, but that's the thing.
It's worked out pretty good.
Yeah. And that's the thing is, yeah, a tool is a tool, right? But if you have the passion, you have the drive and you have the creativity and know-how, you are going to put that tool to work to make beauty, you know? It's going to happen.
And that was the whole thing, was I got it. And then I'm like, all right, well, I can't embarrass myself with this. And, you know, that was how I got in. You know, I did Reducation, and that was, you know, I met, you know, Steve and John who came out to Australia and ran that for us. And one of the craziest things that happened at that, and this is, you know, a lot of my story is because of, you know, my time there, was I was at Reducation with, you know, those wonderful fellas teaching us how to use the camera. And sitting next to me was this dude, Tim Bonathan. And, he was telling me about the surfing stuff he did. And like back in, I think it was 1998 or 99, I can't remember. It was like Biggest Wednesday was the film that he produced. And again, you know, I'm a bit of a, you know, bit of a beach bum surfy myself.
Yeah.
And Matt, I remember watching Biggest Wednesday. I was staying up at Calandra. I was at the beach and like me and one of my dudes were like, where they're watching this thing and I'm like, holy shit. Like imagine shooting, you know, waves, like just the craziest thing I've ever seen. And then sitting next to me in that room, you know, 15 years later is the man that made the film that I was watching as a teenager. Yeah.
I consider him to be probably the biggest legend in filmmaking history. I mean, we maybe have to take Bruce Brown, Endless Summer version, you know, that older version out of the scenario, but it's like, yeah, Tim is an absolute legend.
And he's still popping it out now. Like the man's killing it. The man is a weapon. And this is what happened with my, you know, my dive into the red world was like just the craziest stuff kept happening, because what it did was for somebody, you know, that sort of had no path into that world, it opened doors that didn't exist previously. And, you know, I found myself, you know, in a room with people that, you know, knew what they were doing, knew what they were talking about. And, you know, by osmosis, like you start to learn because you start, you know, everyone was so cool with it. Like there was no, and, you know, I know this is different depending on personalities, but there was no sort of real pulling of rank. People were just, they were all high level creators that just wanted to make beautiful work. And I love that. Like, I love that so much. And that was, you know, I think that was one of the things that really, you know, really pushed me, was that, you know, I'm like, I want to do, you know, I want to respect these tools and, you know, again, do beautiful work with this stuff.
Yeah, that's not a one-off story too, because I love that you had that experience. And I know some people that went to Reducation multiple times, not because they'd forgotten what they learned or, you know, wanted to just brush up or see what they could learn new, but also from the networking perspective.
Oh,
I watched so much networking happen through that program.
Totally.
It's really cool.
Like just, it's such a commitment to, again, you know, to buy into that ecosystem. So the people that are there, and it's the thing that I've come to appreciate in, you know, any world I've spent a lot of time in, and, you know, motorsport and musical theater, hilariously, are two of the places I've spent a lot of time. And the people that are at the pinnacle of those things, like there's nowhere else I'd rather be. And it's exactly the same in terms of, you know, operators, cinematographers. Again, I'd say it to anyone that'll listen, you know, it's a complex life choice. So, you know, if you've had the capacity to turn that into something that pays your way, like you're all in, you are fully committed. You know, you are not there for the stroke of the ego. You are there because there is nothing else in this world that you would rather be doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. You wouldn't make it past the first few months if it wasn't for the right reasons, right? The first couple knockdowns, if you will, and things like that, because they'll happen.
Yeah. Oh, dude.
Yeah.
It,
You have to
because
be
it's
all in
it,
with the heart for sure.
yeah, because the learning curve was exponential. And look, one of the things I've got to jump to that is, you know, around that sort of time, mate, working with David Fincher, Mindhunter, you gotta, mate, how was that experience? Because I watch
Yeah.
something that I love about his work, and again, you know, I can watch at a distance, so I don't have to deal with anything else. But like the precision that that
Yeah,
man
he's
chooses to work with
it's a
astonishes
good word to
me.
use because he's got to be the most precise film director I've ever worked with, and you know,
Yeah.
notorious for it. Yeah, I spent a lot of time around him, with him, and you know, from House of Cards, I worked on multiple seasons there, Gone Girl, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo a little bit,
Yes.
and then yeah, Mindhunter was out there for a bit of that as well. He is an absolute genius. I mean,
Yeah.
there's no other way to put it. You know,
Oh.
there's so many stories that go around about how tough it might be to work for him because it is a very precise vision and it will be executed
Correct.
the way he needs it to be done. And but then also, even if you know, I'm working with some of these crews that are like, I am miserable working on this show. You know, you come to a week or two later and they're like, I've never been better at my job than than I am
Oh,
right
dude.
now because David's helped get me there.
Yeah, mate, he whips you into line. It was stuff like one of the, oh man, one of the things that blew me away that I read was, you know, there was a curb, in one of the shots, and it had, you know, an access part so that, you know, an all abilities access, and he actually had that cloned out because at that point in time the curb wouldn't have looked like that.
Yeah, because of Disability Act, the ADA is what we
Yeah.
call it in America, the Disability Act, where basically now every sidewalk has to have some kind
Yes.
of ramp going down for wheelchair access. And that's the thing. Maybe some folks would never even think about that, but even if they thought
No.
about it, they're like, well, I'm not going to change that. How much time
No,
and money is that going
you're
to
paying the
spend? But
ass.
that's every single aspect of something. But you know, there's something truly special about him because his vision is so precise, but also it's so well thought out all the way down the line to where like somebody
Yeah.
could ask him the most random question because something just changed, something fell over, or something broke, or the lighting just changed, and a major decision needs to happen. And anybody else, they'd be like, David, this happened. What do we do about this? And anybody else would have to look at it, process. Okay, let me think. He has an answer immediately. It's like I watched him do that
Amazing.
multiple times where somebody would ask him a question, and no matter how complex the situation, he would fire off an answer so immediately that you just knew everything is so well thought out and precise in his vision and how he wants everything executed that he doesn't have to think about anything. It comes natural. But
And that's
yeah,
just the
he's a
great,
wizard.
yeah. And I think that that's the best bit about, you know, getting to be around these sort of people is getting to watch their work and watch their style and watch how they, you know, watch what influences them and watch what drives them. And that was where I also had to ask you about, you know, you're obviously involved on set with Game of Thrones, and you got to tell me a little bit about what it was like to be part of, you know, I mean, that's modern day epic. You know, modern day just
Totally is.
phenomenal storytelling. That was
Yeah.
real game changing stuff. I mean, that's like when The Sopranos came out or The Wire or, you know, like beautiful long form, just gorgeous. And then, you know, that obviously took it up to a whole other level. Like what stood out to you being part of that?
I mean, the part I was out there for was one of their biggest scenes, and I can never remember the episode, but it's basically where the White Walkers and the Wildlings and everybody clash and fight, and it's the biggest battle scene of the entire series.
Yeah.
The episode's just slipping my mind right now, but it was one of the most intense on-set environments I've ever been in. It was great. You know, I was there for multiple reasons. They wanted to use my water housing, and so I was teching the water housing for them, building some things into it to make it work the way they wanted to. And but then on top of that, at that point it was a mixed bag of what cameras they were using. But that at that point they started really starting to heavily go towards putting a lot of reds on set. And then for
Yes.
this giant battle scene, I mean, they had, gosh, I wish I could remember the accurate number, but I want to say it was like 17 red epics on set, on the cranes, people running, you know, people dressed in full costume, so they're part of the battle scene, but what you can't see is they've actually got a camera in their hand, you know, so it's the POV style stuff like that. it was gnarly. I mean, to say the least. We watched somebody, I gotta say, almost die, where, you know, there's a point in the battle scene where all the wildlings are going and running off this dock and jumping into this big boat to try to escape, and these boats are made out of real legit timber that they look like they could weigh a ton, you know, they at least. And so when the last person jumps in to flip the boat over, they've got a full-size construction crane overhead that just pulls two wires and flips the thing over. So first take they did, it knocked somebody out cold, and he's trapped under the boat. Luckily, they have plenty of safety divers in the water who run and get him out. He's totally unconscious still, you know, after being underwater. They get him. Luckily, didn't have to resuscitate him, but you saw the look on his face, like he'd just seen the light, or maybe lack thereof, which might be even more disturbing.
That's tough to have the office.
Yeah, so that happened on the first take of that shot, and then there was okay, that cannot happen, this, that, and the other. But we're going to try it one more time.
One more time.
And go, I did it one more time.
We're going to do one for safety.
Yeah, exactly. It was intense.
Just one more time. It was intense. That happens on every set.
Yeah. I came back with pneumonia that I had for like 2 months after that shoot. It was, you know, up to our ankles, if not knees deep in mud every single day, like an hour and a half north of Belfast, Northern Ireland, and wild, like in a rock quarry, just rugged situations.
That's ridiculous. And so you've got a fairly phenomenal breadth of the work that you've done, you know, in terms of the sorts of stuff that you've been on, you know, from the nature to doco to, you know, run and gun to, you know, sort of as big as you can get. And then, you know, the part that I really want to lead into is, you know, towards your work, because you've obviously, you know, now with, you know, Base Film and, you know, a lot of the work that you're doing now, I really want to lead into how it came to be that you managed to get yourself onto Ocean X for their maiden voyage. Is that a similar knocking on the door story, or did they come and talk to you?
Sort of, but no, they came to me, but it was also after a long relationship with them, I guess. Before Ocean X existed, it was Alusha Productions, which, if you've seen Blue Planet 2, the opening episode where David Attenborough is standing out on the front of a beautiful research vessel, that was the Alusha. And so I worked with them a couple times. Oh gosh, this has to be 6 years ago or something like that. Maybe no more than that now. And it was helping integrate the camera systems in the submarines. That was also being helped by John Elbach, Brock from Gates. And so I worked with them back then, and then continued talks with them throughout the years about certain projects. And then came to be, after leaving Red, you know, it was, you know, I was trying to make it known that I'm trying to go full pedal to the metal when it comes to the freelance world. And they came to me with something I regrettably had to say no to, and then came back to ask me, okay, so that was a test run, that was kind of a working out the kinks thing, but now that we've done that, we're about to have our maiden voyage. It's in the Red Sea, in a part of the Red Sea, which is in Saudi Arabian waters, off of Neom, which is this really interesting story in itself that I won't get too far into. But it's ocean area that has been inaccessible, let's say, to science, to, you know, outsiders up until this time, and they were trying to open it up and allow science to come in and do research and allow us to document this. That was an amazing trip. Yeah, it was, overall, we were on board for about 7 weeks or so. I did like 43 days of diving, scuba diving, where I was probably doing 2 to sometimes 4 dives a day. When I wasn't doing that, I was in the submarines operating, you know, 2 cameras, one with a macro lens, one with a wide lens. And it's basically, you know, you're working with these big giant kind of gimbals and follow focus units And if I wasn't doing that, then I was on board possibly operating the camera that was on the ROV. And we discovered amazing amounts of new species, but also like shipwrecks. And
Oh,
that's
wow.
when I got my really first taste of truly brand new archaeological findings and
And
filming
that's like
those.
Indiana Jones stuff there. Like you're
Oh, I
like
mean,
for the first
we all
time.
want to be explorers, right? Like
Yeah,
that's
dude, that's what I'm
especially
here, man. I want the hat and the whip and I want to go and find
totally,
the unknown.
totally. I mean, as a kid,
Dude.
you want to be an explorer, you want to be an astronaut,
Totally.
and I felt like doing both of them, you know what I mean? Because
Yeah.
we were literally looking at something that nobody's ever seen before,
Nobody's seen
and
it.
I'm film not only and am I also filming it for the first time, and some of them I know still haven't been filmed again since. But
Wow.
I've been back to that area a couple times. I actually just got back 3 weeks ago now, maybe a little over 2 weeks
Yeah.
ago, from the same area, doing kind of similar work. It's more commercial work, but also at the same time, you're focused around these new sites and these new areas that haven't been filmed before.
Oh man, that like, and I can only imagine, like the buzz on the ship, each time, there's a, because how many people are on board? Like, how big is the crew
Oh
on this?
boy.
On.
Hundreds for sure, but there I'm trying to just remember how many scientists there were, because there was,
Yeah.
I want to say there was like 40 something scientists.
Yeah, wow.
I was the only underwater specific camera operator on board, which
Nice.
is quite a treat and quite a an amount of pressure as well. But
Yeah.
and
Because who else do you
then
talk camera tech with? I mean, like that's, whenever we're on the job, all we do is we sit around and we talk cameras.
Well, sure, and then there's some topside crews, and some of the big stories they were trying to tell were following the scientists and the research they were doing out
Yeah.
there. So you'd have some topside crew following them,
Oh,
and then I
cool.
would follow
Oh, so
them
you still got someone
underwater.
to talk tech with.
Yeah, we still you
That's important.
still yeah shop talk. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that's important.
We still could nerd out, but yeah, it was incredible.
Because it does like that stuff that I've seen of you I've seen photos of you in the submersible and yeah operating down under the water. Because I mean, how do you find like what's the transition between when you're working obviously holding a housing to then work, is it similar to like doing helicopter work, or how what's the translation there?
Yeah, definitely. Cameras mounted on the outside of a submarine feels a lot like helicopter work. Just not
Yeah.
as rapid. The gimbals and I love doing heli work too, like aerials and then like a nice shot of a
Yeah.
rig. But that's
Mate,
fast and
that's
reactive and
killer.
just
Yeah.
so smooth. Whereas the submarine stuff, the way we were doing it at the time at least, it's typically you're framing your shot and then you're communicating with the sub pilot and letting the sub do a lot of the work. So
Oh, right.
whereas in aerial work, a lot of times we let the gimbal do the movement and the position, the panning and the tilting or whatever the plan shot is. Whereas a lot of times I would try to get ourselves framed where we are now, where we want to be, communicated with the sub pilot. And a lot of times we would let the sub do a lot of the motion work. Or then if it was the macro stuff, a lot of times it was just trying to get the sub settled, sitting still, not scaring a critter, or
Of
work it.
course.
We had lights that would come out on a retractable
Yeah,
track
out
and
off the
things like that,
side.
and
Yep.
try to backlight pieces of coral. They discovered all kinds of new species of coral in the area, discovered some brine pools, shipwrecks, like I was saying, crazy stuff.
Shipwrecks would be cool. Like when you see that under the water, like that, were you under? Were you
There was
when you came
a
across
couple
those
there was
things? Or
multiple times, yeah.
wow.
Without saying too much about one, it was
No, of
definitely one of the
course.
biggest archaeological finds we had. We saw the artifacts
Yeah.
and we were filming the artifacts. And then when we went back down a second time, I kind of tried to follow the path of the artifacts. And then I saw the outline of a ship. I saw
Wow.
the ship basically like a triangular
Oh, man.
shape of a ship. And at this point, I'm still a little bit above it. I'm about 15, 20 meters above it. And I know that thing is probably at about, I would let's say 30 meters. And we're on nitrox, which is a mixed
Yeah.
blend where it's a high amount of oxygen. So there's a certain point where you can't go deeper
No.
than your maximum operating depth, or else you get oxygen poisoning
Yeah,
basically and die.
quite bad.
So I could tell that's pretty close to my MOD right there, but got down to it and got closer and could tell there were wood beams, and then found the anchor And at this point, I'm trying to communicate in hand signal and very excited hand signals. What I'd find totally, and I'm trying to say, like, you know, as we're coming back up a little bit, trying to get out of that depth and start working towards the artifacts again. I'm trying to tell them, like, look here. You see the shape. And nobody got it until we got back on board and I pulled up the footage. And they're like, look. Oh, like,
whoa.
There it is. Yes, that's a ship. Okay. But yeah, that was an amazing moment. That was wild.
Your other thing, you'd be down there going, Matt, I hope I'm not like tripping balls down here because, you know.
Well, especially but, you get narcosis. Like, oh, yeah.
Am I seeing things, or is that what?
Yeah. And narcosis is often referred to as like being a little bit drunk. So yeah, you do kind of have to question yourself.
Correct.
But once I found the anchor, it was a good personal moment. I'm like, okay,
That's definitely an anchor. Now, look, one of the other things I've got to run past you is I am always super impressed. When you post photos of the work that you're doing in the big tanks with NASA.
Oh, cool. Yeah, like, that's...
Yeah, man, the NASA stuff is just cool. I mean, that, you know, whenever I see that, and, you know, obviously I know that there's so much that goes in, and, you know, this is the highlight reel stuff, and there's so much that goes into making all this happen. But, man, when I see those moments, I'm like, go, man, like, that is, like, rock and roll. That is so cool.
You it's said it though, yeah. You don't post the bad times typically. Yeah.
No, you never do. It's the highlight reel. But it's imagining that phone call going, "G'day, Sean. This is NASA. Can you come and teach the astronauts some stuff?" And you're like, "Did that just happen?"
It is like, the coolest environment. Yeah, I honestly like
literally go into space.
And this is. I try to keep myself in check and not get too. you know, just blown away by the moments I find myself in, but that's stuff. It's pretty hard not to just totally geek out. Man. Yeah. The first time I went there was about 8 years ago, and it was for a total different purpose than the last couple times I've been. Where 8 years ago I was there to film for a documentary called A Year in Space. It was produced by Time, formerly Time Magazine. They ended up selling it to PBS or however that works. It ended up winning an Emmy, which was really cool too. But that was the first time I was there, and we're filming Scott Kelly's last training sessions in the tank before he is about to leave for Kazakhstan, get in quarantine, and then go into space for an entire year. First person to ever do it. And it just surreal does not work for a word.
No,
just so entire time. That. It was there very amazing though. It was so cool. It was so cool. But yeah, I've been lucky enough to go back two more times, and they have a video department there that, you know, constantly they are recording video. They have a team that has these cameras that are wired into basically the mission control, and mission control will be walking the astronauts through training scenarios about what they are about to go up into the International Space Station and do, like repairs. Let's say one of the times that we were filming them basically replace these gigantic batteries that are, you know, the size of a small car, stuff like that. But what they can be doing also is, and this is mind blowing to me, is they're walking through these scenarios and they're broadcasting that to the International Space Station to walk the astronauts that are up there through the process of like, okay, we're going to walk through it here for you underwater in Houston, Texas at the Johnson Space Center. And then you just go ahead and put your suit on and hop out there and do that in space now. So that's wild. But the other part of that scenario is they have a department that films things that are more for their promotional aspects.
Of course.
Yeah, I mean, they got so much cool stuff going on there, including, you know, now they're working on the lunar program where, you know, they're about to set up a moon base, basically. So, you know, big portion of the Neutral Buoyancy Lab, the NBL, is blacked off to try to keep it dark when they need it to be. And they've got this like kinetic sand on the bottom that's supposed to mimic the sand on the moon if you would to throw it in that amount of gravity.
Yeah.
So it doesn't, you know, just plume up and fill the whole water column. Oh, so wild. Yeah, a bunch of heroes over there. It's wild.
That is so that's the work that you got your Emmy for. That's that one. Is that correct?
A year in space, yeah.
A year in space. And like, tell me about that experience. I mean, you know, what's that like I don't think as a creator, there is, to me, there's nothing more wonderful than the acknowledgement of your peers. And that's sort of a very high, you know, where your peers go, yeah, good work, Chief.
Yeah. I mean, I got to say, I played a very small role in that very large project, but I'm so proud to have done it. And also I just feel so blessed for the opportunity and the experience.
Yeah, I get that.
But yeah, I mean, amazing crew of documentary filmmakers that made the episodes and followed them out to Kazakhstan, did all the real work of following him, Scott Kelly, through the human emotions of what he was about to do and the real human stories of it. And then I got to do a little more of the fun stuff of shooting it underwater. But we made it real stylistic in a way that I haven't been able to do again, where, you know, it was a much darker environment and we got to control lighting and do some really fun stuff with that.
And that would have been one of the biggest things because, yeah, so much of what you do, you're working in, I guess, a live environment, whereas that would have actually been a controlled space where you could tinker with it and go, oh, hey, guys, could we just try this?
And sure. And typically in those scenarios, we're like, when I've been back a couple times after, it's for the most part, you're trying to stay out of the way. The last thing you want to do is all of a sudden an astronaut runs into the dome port of your housing because you're trying to get this close shot or something. Yeah. Ooh. I know you're doing something, but I'm trying to get a shot here.
Yeah.
So that one was
fly on the wall. Stay back.
Yeah, that one was it was known that this is a big story about Scott, and so that there was a little more leeway to get experimental. And just an incredible situation. I mean, there's 25 stories wrapped into the first hours of that shoot that I won't even get into at the moment.
But the rigs were going up into space too. That was one of the things that was happening. Was like the epics were going up into space, and I remember seeing them, you know, just in case it wasn't cool enough. Like they're literally, you know, shooting them in space, and I'm like, can you guys stop this? Like that's just awesome. Because did you have to do some of the training with some of the guys that took them up, or
those? You know, is really interesting. No, to be short about that, but I mean, they had been trained, and also like they.
Yeah.
The astronauts that go up there are already so technically minded, and a lot of them are already photographers.
Yeah, nice.
Both Terry and I know Terry's a big photographer, and Scott himself was like, after the shoot we did in the tank, we went out and grabbed beers. You know, it was Scott's last night in town, and he's got a million people to talk to, and he wanted to come over and talk to me about the red cameras. I'm like, this is so weird.
Dude. Again, for real. Like, that's. Yeah. You're like, me?
Yeah.
But again, you know, if you love cameras, it's the same as what I was saying on Ocean X. You just need people there to talk, because you can talk tech forever is what I have found with my, you know, whenever I travel with crews, like we go and have a few beers and we just talk cameras for hours. Yeah. So it's
And
it's
when you're around the people that don't care about that stuff, that's when you really realize it. Because like, oh my gosh, are you still
mate,
going?
You see the eyes roll back in the head and like, can you idiots shut up?
Yes.
Like, what? This is the best. We're terrible to go to the cinema with as well. If you're,
totally.
Like, look at the richness of those blacks, and they're going, what is wrong with you?
Yep. It's really funny because my wife, that is one of her favorite sayings, is I'll go like, oh my god, that looks like crap. She goes, oh, did they not crush the blacks enough? I'm like, oh, thanks,
Stop
babe.
It. That's cute.
She's got these little bits. She's always heard me, you know, complain about and stuff while watching movies.
We are all the same now.
But I'm also a writer, so unfortunately I feel like most things I watch, I've seen 2 minutes of it and I could tell you exactly how this whole thing can go. And that's the worst. I need to shut up.
That makes it tough.
Yeah.
Now, with the work that you're doing now, so you're obviously, mate, you're pursuing the passion. You've gone all in to
indeed
doing your own thing.
Yeah, indeed, man. And loving it. You know, I've been really, really blessed to have some regular clients and, you know, some companies like Base Films, who I've been working with a good bit, going back to NEOM at least once a year for the past 3 years, which has been incredible. But also doing some cinema work that like to me, you know, my heart and my childhood energy, my childlike energies, I should say, and everything, it's still always going to be in nature. It's going to be in the ocean, but I love doing cinema work. Like I mean, it's that's also another part of me where I thought I would be a feature film director until I actually spent enough time on feature film sets and realized, no, I don't want to do that. Yeah. And so to be a specialty operator, you know, to be able to come in and sometimes just day play, if not, you know, 2-3 days on, you know, a 4 or 5 month project, and get some specialty shots for them. That's my favorite. I love
it. That's just the right amount, because you don't have to suffer through the whole process. You just get to rock into a bit and then leave. Guys, see you guys. Have fun.
Totally. And I'm down for the longer term projects, of course, too. But there is something special about when it's a small, kind of concentrated, concise effort of we know we have to get this, and it is a specialty type of thing, you know, then the efforts that go into it and everything and the attention that go into it. And then again, the pressures involved with it too. Oh, it's amazing. Like, okay, well, got to get this done now.
The opportunity to do your best work is to that, you know, this is it. You need to give all your attention to this one thing. You don't have to divide it across, you know, a great many and, 100%. You know, just put all your knowledge, all your skills into making that exceptional.
Mm, absolutely.
Because has any of that work really, have you noticed a change in the way that you approach your work over these last couple of years now that it's, you know, you for you?
I don't know if it's changed in just because it's me doing it from a freelance perspective versus, you know, when I was at Red, a lot of times I was doing my freelance work during my vacation time. So every vacation day was basically spent doing that type of thing. But my work has changed through my own progression, from my own experience and what I've learned over time, 100%, you know, it's always maturing. I want to say it's always progressing. And some of that also ends up happening way before you hit the water. You know, just my knowledge base is, I'm trying to constantly expand my knowledge base and training so that, you know, when somebody tells me, you know, there's this crazy scenario we want to shoot in this specific way, I could pre-plan on how to set it up for success versus try to guess and hopefully make it happen. Shooting the opening sequence to a movie, The Colony, which is on Netflix. That's the whole opening sequence is an underwater setup. And it was being shot on these Hawk anamorphics with a vintage 65, you know, full frame lenses. And there was only one set that existed in the entire world. And they're being used on this show. So there's no way I could test before I get out to Germany to shoot this or anything like that. It was literally just trying to come in with what I could pre-plan, what I have known, what questions I could ask to my peers and my mentors, and kind of come in and make it all work. And somehow it did. but it was, you know, there's, you know, you're talking about just to physically make the thing fit. There's not a millimeter left over of space in certain areas on the gears and things like that to make it all fit. But then just to make it fit is one thing. To make it optically perform properly. And yeah, it's so, you know, challenges like that are fun. So it's, you know, it's that's the mental game of it all too, instead of just the physical game.
Well, and that is it, isn't it? It's that mental preparation where you, and I'm sure you're the same, you know, where I'll spend, you know, whatever the job is, I'll spend days, weeks, months, you know, thinking through the job, thinking through, you know.
Absolutely.
Like even this stuff that I do here, like the amount of work you put into testing a setup, you know, just to make sure it works, and you go to bed thinking about it, going, oh, what if I did that cable, and what if I split this, and what if I tried that? Like you just can't help yourself, can you? Like
this, so you could be thinking about it for months, and those thoughts right there are definitely going to pop up the night before, especially the night before getting on an airplane or something like that.
Oh, totally. Could you try to make sure? Because this is one of the funniest things, and it's something I've actually never understood about myself. I'm actually like super forgetful and, you know, a bit of a shambles. But when it comes to like packing my kit, like I can remember like down to the screw what is required, because I do like a mental build in my head and then I'll lay it all out and then pack it all away. And I've never understood how I can have like such a photographic memory when it comes to camera gear. I have never understood that.
I am exactly with you. Honestly, every trip I pack for, I kind of step back eventually, and I'm kind of blown away, like, whoa, how did that just happen? And it's some of it is so automatic. I know I've already thought it out months in advance, and I've already sometimes done it before and been through it, even though some of the elements might change. But then I get everything perfectly packed, perfectly fit. There's not a millimeter to spare in this case, and I weigh it, and it's literally, you know, a gram or two underneath the weight allowance. I'm like,
I got the scales. Whoa. Yeah. It blows. Yeah. Like I find that endlessly weird.
Yeah.
Having that super bizarre skill set that I don't have for anything else. Like,
I can't apply it to very much else in my life.
Anything else in my life. Except, you know, when I pack, because, you know, and you'd be the same. Whenever you're doing international trips, you know, sometimes you have trouble with what you can take in and what you can fly and what you.
True.
And I, like, it is so. I'm trying to actually think of an occasion where I've forgotten something. Mm. And, like, I don't think it exists.
I second guess myself the whole way. But then once I'm there and I prep everything and set it up and then I remind myself, I'm like, yeah, you made checklists and you've done this a million times and you know you've had sleepless nights staying up thinking about these things already. So that's why.
Correct.
Whether we know it or not, we are constantly working on it and we're training ourselves. It's just I think kind of
It's obsessive, weird. And it comes back to that point where I go, you know, this is a terrible life choice. But, you know, if you're all in, if you're fully committed, it actually ends up being like the greatest adventures of your whole life.
Right. And,
you know, and this is the nice very part true. Is, you know, and I've got to thank you for this because, you know, you've played a very big part in that for me. In particular, how you managed to wrangle me into some of the red parties at when I was over there for Cinegear. And, you know, not too similar to yourself. I'm like, hey Sean, can you get me in?
Yeah, totally. I love it.
The relentlessness, mate. When I want something,
no, there was never a doubt though. Hold on, I'm not going. No, he's not going. No, I'm not. Scott's getting in.
I'm getting in because I remember watching like the year before I'd thought about going, and I remember watching a live stream. I think Jared was actually posting something. And he was letting off fireworks in the car park. Yeah. And I was sitting in my lounge room at home with my wife. And I'm like, man, I could have been there watching this loose cannon, you know, shoot fireworks. And then 12 months later, I was standing there watching that loose cannon, you know, shooting off fireworks at Red. And I'm like, man, in this person, is my dreams coming true. Like, I'm literally living this dream.
Yeah, that ended up becoming a tradition. Yeah.
Man, it's a tradition. And then, like, the next year is, and you see, I was. Oh my God. And it was ending up chatting. It was the fact that I'd be there with all these people that I knew from the internet that, you know, and I'd known from Red User and stuff that, you know, like absolute just superstars of the game. And I'm there like having beers with them and talking shop with them. And you're just there going, this is just crazy.
Yeah. It's so cool professionally too, from a networking standpoint, but not that any of us were thinking about that at the moment. Cause we're just all coming together with like, a similar spirit, and like you said too, you know, we all kind of jumped in with Red and in digital cinema and in this industry in general with this kind of this optimism of I'm gonna effing do it, it's just gonna happen no matter what,
it's just gonna happen.
And so yeah, the vibes are all similar between everybody, it's a celebration of the vibe.
Well, to make something of yourself, you know, in this industry, there's no other way. Like, if you are not obsessive and relentless, you know, with absolute singular focus, like, you won't do it. And I've watched people try to get into it, that, and you can see the half-heartedness from them. And they're the ones that, you know, 12 months later are long gone. That Fincher mindset where you're looking at the footpath going, no. That's the one.
Indeed.
Look, my dude, I'm very conscious of your time. If people want to follow your adventures, all the cool stuff you do, if they want to, you know, get you out on their next big feature, how do we follow Mr. Sean Ruggieri around the internet?
Love it. Thanks for the plug. Yeah. Telepathyproductions.com is my website. Got some samples of my work. I'm so long overdue to sit down and finish a reel I've got to do. But telepathyproductions.com and Snap a Map on Instagram.
Snap a Map.
I don't stay as active as I need to be on there nowadays, but yeah.
You just got to post the cool stuff you do, but yeah, it takes so much time. Like when you got that dad life and the husband life and the self-employed life, I get you, man. That's,
you know,
it's hard work. What I'll do is I'll throw links to all those things. So if people want to find you and track you down and chat stupid things, then they can find you that way. But Sean, I'm so grateful, my man. When are we going to see you in Australia next? Have you anything on the cards?
I got to get back. I don't yet, but I've got to get back. I miss you all over there. I just miss that beautiful land of yours. Mate, and I've got, sooner or later. What's that?
And there's some wrecks at Moreton Island. Like,
less than
60 minutes from, you've probably already dived them.
Nope, I have not. Man,
when you come over next time, I'm going to take you over there and we're going diving on the wrecks.
Love it. I love it. Yes. I appreciate your time too, Scott. Thanks so much for having me on, man.
Dude, I am so stoked, mate. Thank you, Sean. This has been the most wonderful conversation, and I appreciate you, my friend. Thank you.
And I will see you over there soon. I want some barbecue and beer and see your beautifully manicured lawn.
Barbecue, beers, and lawn, mate. You know it. Bit of putt-putt out the back. I cannot wait, my friend. All right. Thanks, brother.
Take care, Scott. Thank you.